You are listening to a podcast from Raritan Valley Community College.
Good afternoon, everyone. There are seats in the front. We're about to begin. Welcome to Visualizing Civil Rights Series, Trayvon Martin. My name is Richelene DeShields. I'm the Dean of Multicultural Affairs, and I welcome you to our first fall program. As America celebrates the 50th anniversary of Dr. Martin Luther King's March on Washington, the tragic death of a young African-American student forced the nation to examine the judicial system, racial profiling, and civil rights in America. Trayvon Martin is the first of a series of programs that will span the entire year here at Raritan. The Visualizing Civil Rights Series is co-sponsored by the RVCC Evelyn S. Field Library, the Department of Humanities, Social Science, and Education, the Office of Multicultural Affairs, and also a grant by the National Endowment for Humanities and Gilder Lehrman Institute of American History. Raritan Valley Community College was awarded a grant which gave us a set of four films chronizing the history of civil rights movement. The powerful documentaries include The Abolitionists, Slavery by Another Name, Freedom Riders, and The Loving Story, which highlight 150 years effort to achieve equal rights for all. Freedom Rider received an Emmy in 2012. The Loving Story and The Abolitionist were also Emmy nominated in 2013. The films are part of creating Equal American Civil Rights Struggle, an initiative by the National Endowment for Humanities. The National Endowment for Humanities provides powerful documentary films to encourage community discussions of American civil rights history. Before I introduce our esteemed panel, I would like to be able to introduce our interim president here at Raritan Valley Community College, Mr. Jim Vintantonio.
Thank you, and welcome to this first panel on the civil rights movement. Those of us of an age who were involved with the civil rights movements in the 60s are reminded that we have to analyze periodically where we've come from or how far we still have to go. I am reminded of Dr. King's comment that injustice anywhere threatens justice everywhere. So I think this is an excellent panel, and I look to listen to the distinguished panelists. Thank you so much.
Our president was very modest in his commitment towards social justice. He has a long-serving commitment to the state of New Jersey and also to higher education and his own advocacy for social justice. So he definitely is a resource for our programs here, and we're very pleased to be able to have introduced him to the campus community on this September 12th. For those in the audience that have a seat open, could you please just raise your hand, because we have a number of people in the back who are standing, and I would love for our guests to be seated before I introduce our panelists. Our esteemed panelists all have diverse expertise, but they are connected by their commitment to social justice and civil rights. Our first panelist is our own Maria DeFlippius, who is a lawyer and also coordinator of our RVCC Paralegal Studies Program. Next to her, we have our esteemed faculty member from the Department of English, Ronald Tyson. We also have two representatives from our local communities. Thank you. I appreciate everyone. From our local community, Reginald Johnson, who is an agent for the Middlesex County Prosecutor Office. Also, he is the president of the Metuchen Middlesex County branch of the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. Reginald Johnson has also served as chairman of the Middlesex County Cultural Heritage Commission and also the Middlesex County Human Relations Commission, which is an organization that addresses the growth of bias-related incidences in the county. Next to Reginald, we have Alex Gray, Dr. Alex Gray. Alex is an assistant principal at Quibbletown Middle School in Piscataway. After serving as a school counselor for 12 years, Alex is a proud member of Kappa Alpha Psi fraternity, where he also serves as coordinator for their Guide Right initiative and Kappa Leaguer mentoring program. Guide Right is a national service program geared towards educating and promoting the success of young men. Last but not least is our moderator, Barbara Cedar. Barbara actually is the convener of this program and the creator in terms of the idea of having such a panel today. During the summer, as we all know, Trayvon Martin's trial came to an end. And for many of us, we were in separate parts of the country or separate parts of the state of New Jersey. But Barbara Cedar definitely had the vision and the foresight to say that as a community, it is a teachable moment. It is a defining factor for many students here. This is the moment that defines your civil rights. For me, it may have been Rodney King. It may have been Emmett Till for others. But for our students here at Raritan, Trayvon Martin's case touched all of our hearts. And I had the privilege of being actually at the Schomburg Institute in New York City, which is part of the New York library system. I was surrounded by a diverse group of educators, and we had a conversation that was very impactful, not only for my role as Dean of Multicultural Affairs here at Raritan, but also as a mother of young African-American men, too, as well. So I thank Barbara Cedar for her foresight, for her vision, and I am sure that each of us will gain more knowledge and insight and be more active in our commitment towards civil rights. Again, I would like to just remind everyone that I will be sending out to the entire campus community an announcement letting you know that this program is podcast, so you can take another opportunity to listen to it, share that with other community members, other students, your family too as well, and continue this fight for civil rights and for social justice. Thank you.
We lost our signal. I'd like to also welcome you here. I became very interested in the case and following it, not because of the issues of social justice, although they concern me, but the divisions in our society. Like many other issues, and again, some of us who are much older, we go back to the O.J. Simpson case, Rodney King and so forth. We recall that while there was a lot of interest in the trial, people across races didn't talk with each other about it. The research on Rodney King coming out of the Pew Center suggests that this is both a racial and generational issue, that whites were far less interested in following the case than African Americans. Older people thought it was less significant than younger people. So many of us have, as Rochelle points out, our defining moment. When we start thinking about, is there justice in America for all of us? And I believe that for many young people, this was the case. My granddaughter, who is biracial, said to me, "My friends and I could be Rodney King." And as I choked up, I said, "Yes, you could." I don't think my older son or his friends said I could be Rodney King. They're older, they're beyond that. So this program today is not our program. I'm hoping this is your program. We would like to hear your voices. I have four wonderful panelists, and they're going to just introduce their take on Rodney King. We'll have some questions, but then we have mics out there. We want to hear your questions. We want to hear your opinions. Thank you. And we'll begin with Maria DeFilippis.
I think you guys missed it. This is your name.
Yeah, we decided to go by height, so I get to be the first speaker. What I want you to do is help me out here and take out your cell phones, because I'm going to ask you guys for a little bit of help with this presentation. Yeah. All right, well, let's blacken this out for a minute. Okay, so, I'm Maria DeFilippis, and I'm an attorney, and I just want you to know that when I first heard the news about a 17-year-old unarmed kid being shot to death in Florida, I was pretty sick over it. As the story unfolded over the months in the media, I was angry to hear about it all. And when the verdict came down, I was really bummed. I was very disappointed. That's how I felt as a person. But how I felt as an attorney is kind of a different story. So I want to ask all of you to help me answer this question. Have you ever done these polls? You can text to the number at the top, 37607, or you can go on the Internet. And I'd like you to answer this question for me. If you text it or go to the Internet, if your answer is true, that you believe the jury system worked appropriately in this case, you would text 626 that you get it. And if you think it's false, I don't need to explain this to you because you understand it better than I do, don't you? Right. So I'll give you a second this first time around. Should have one of those. Do, 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 do. All right, we're up there. We got like about 29:30. All right, 32 is a good number. Oh, we got 33, 34, 35. Ooh, good for you guys. I'm impressed. All right, let's see where we go. So, this is how many we have. We have 11 of you who think that the jury system worked appropriately in this case, and 29 of you who think it did not. Actually, I thought we'd have even fewer people with the true and many more with the false, so this is sort of heartening to me when I look at this. I'm going to quote from the president when he spoke about this case. I'm going to paraphrase, actually. But when the president was talking about this case, he basically said, "When you think about this trial, remember, the judge conducted the trial in a professional manner. The prosecution and the defense presented their cases. The jurors got proper instructions under the law, and they rendered their verdict." That's what the president said, you know, more or less. So that's the jury system. It heartens me to hear that from him. He's a lawyer and all of that. But that's the law. So what I think we need to understand when we talk about the jury trial system is that this case wasn't about, what this case was about was whether or not the defendant, George Zimmerman, committed a crime. And if he did he have a legal defense to that crime? That's the only issue that the jury gets to hear. And they decide the answer to those issues by listening to the evidence and the facts that are admitted in the trial. Nothing else. That's all they get to hear. So let's look at a couple of those facts. And let me give you the next question and see what you think. Trayvon Martin was just passing through the gated community on his way to a convenience store when this incident occurred. True or false? Nobody's doing it. Oh, here we go. we got enough. Let's see what we say. You say it was true. Oh, we got a few more falses. All right. Well, actually, it wasn't true. It was false. Trayvon, 17 years old, about 6 foot tall, about 160 pounds. He was actually staying at the gated community. The place was called, I think, the Retreat at Twin Oaks. He was actually living there temporarily with his father's girlfriend. And he had stayed there before with her, and had stayed there other times before, but he was legitimately at the scene in this gated community at the time the incident occurred. Now, George Zimmerman, 5'7", 185 pounds, he was 28 years old, or and he actually lived in Twin Lakes Retreat himself at the time. He lived there with his wife, and he'd been living there since 2009. And about 6 months before this happened, he had been elected by the residents of Twin Lakes to be the neighborhood watch coordinator at their development. Now, add to this the fact that at Twin Lakes, in the year before this incident happened, the police had been called to Twin Lakes over 400 times, something like 412 times, by the residents for various criminal activities, burglaries, thefts, break-ins, shootings, things like that. So there was somewhat of an atmosphere of fear or unsafety in this Twin Lakes community at the time that this incident occurred. Now, although we don't always get, although the jury doesn't always get to hear what we get to hear from the media, these facts were given to the jury during the trial. These things they did know, that both were legitimately there, their ages, their height and weight, and they also were told, and it was a fact in the case, that George Zimmerman legitimately had a license to carry a concealed weapon and had had one since, I believe, 2009. Now, as I said, the jury doesn't always get to hear everything we get to hear, but they did get to hear these facts. But now let's go to the next question, see what we think about this one. Both George Zimmerman and Trayvon Martin had prior criminal records. Anybody voting? Off. Thank you. Oops. How many we got? Ah, 38. That's a good number. We'll stop there. All right. All right. 13 of you said true, 27 false. It is false, so the ayes have it or the nays have it, however that goes, right? Neither of them had a criminal record. However, Trayvon Martin had 3 school suspensions. He was actually on suspension, and that's why his dad took him down to live with him and his girlfriend at Twin Oaks. He was on suspension at the time he was killed. And his suspensions, one was for truancy, one was for destruction of property, like graffiti, and when they arrested him for that or when they picked him up for that, in his backpack he had a bunch of jewelry, women's jewelry in his backpack that he said didn't belong to him. He was never charged with anything. And then his last suspension, the one that he was on at the time, was for marijuana. So that's it. He had no juvenile record, no juvenile criminal record, just his suspensions from school. Zimmerman, on the other hand, had been arrested once. He'd been arrested for shoving a cop. Those charges were dismissed against him. Also, his previous girlfriend had filed a domestic violence complaint against him in court, and he had filed one against her, too, and they had joint restraining orders. They couldn't go near each other. Now, the judge in this case allowed both sides access to juvenile records, adult arrest records, and social media records from both parties, from Trayvon Martin and from George Zimmerman. But after all the evidence came in, the judge determined that none of it was relevant. What that means is the jury didn't get to hear any of that. So all the stuff that you and I knew about Zimmerman having to go to anger management because of that shoving of a police officer, all those things that we read about in the media, the jury was not allowed to hear any of this as evidence at the trial because it wasn't relevant. Typically, prior bad acts, things you've done before that aren't so great, aren't admissible against you in your trial. And why? Why don't we want them to be? We don't want them to be because we want you to be judged on this event. Did you do this or not? Not on all the other things you did that were bad. I think Barbara mentioned O.J. Simpson trial. I mean, his prior bad acts, he had beaten his wife, the victim of the crime previously, none of those were admitted to the jury. Because just because you did something bad once before doesn't necessarily mean you did something bad this time, right? And so we want you to be tried on whether or not you're guilty of this thing, not of all those other things you did that were bad. And for that reason, we don't allow typically prior bad acts into a jury to use to decide a case unless they are relevant. So the judge in this case said they just weren't relevant. So the jury didn't get to hear any of that. So that's an example of all the stuff we get to hear in the media that the jury doesn't actually get to hear in the courtroom. So let's take you to the next one. Attorneys for Zimmerman use Florida's Stand Your Ground law as the cornerstone of their defense. True or false? We got enough to see. Overwhelmingly true. And that's what I expected, but that's a common misunderstanding. They did not use the Stand Your Ground law as his defense. They used a traditional, they presented a case of a traditional self-defense. Now, let me tell you what that means. Every state in the country has a law that provides a defendant with the right of self-defense. It's a common law right. It's been around for a gazillion years since we've been making rights. It didn't start in the United States. It's always been there, the right of self-defense. And basically that right says that if a person is attacked and is in reasonable fear of death or serious injury, that person has the right to defend himself with sufficient force, including lethal force or deadly force, so long as no safe retreat is possible. That's the common law of self-defense. That's the one, you know, that, well, I don't want to say most states, but I will tell you that, before I go further, that's the common law right of self-defense. Stand Your Ground law is a little bit different. It takes the idea of the common law right of self-defense a little bit further. I mean, do you all agree that we ought to have the right to defend ourselves, right? I mean, we pretty much agree that, right? Okay, I hope. But Stand Your Ground law sort of takes that right a step further. What it says is you can defend yourself with lethal force if you're in a place you have a right to be without the need to retreat. So do you understand what that means? You can still defend yourself using the reasonable force or necessary force and even lethal force, but in this case, you don't have to retreat even if you can. That's the main difference between a Stand Your Ground law, and the general right of self-defense, which everybody has. So in case you're interested, 19 states, including Florida, have a Stand Your Ground law. 25 states, including New Jersey, have what we call castle self-defense law. And that comes from the name of a case. And what that means is New Jersey says you always have to retreat if you can unless you're in your own home. Right? So 25 states give you the sort of Stand Your Ground, use deadly force in your own home without retreating. 19 of them say anywhere, you don't have to retreat, right? Like Florida. And then there are 6 states, Vermont's one of them if you want to move to Vermont, that is an always retreat state. No matter where you are, if you can retreat, you should retreat before using deadly force. So that's the issue we're talking about, right? Stand Your Ground versus traditional common law self-defense. Now, if Zimmerman's attorneys had wanted to use the Stand Your Ground law in Florida, they would have had a hearing. And in that hearing, a judge would have listened to the sides, to the two sides, and a judge would have decided if the Stand Your Ground law applied to what happened to Mr. Zimmerman, if he had the right and if he used the right kind of force, etc. And if the judge decided it did, he would have been immune from prosecution. He could not have been tried. He would have never had a trial. Right? And that's what some Stand Your Ground laws do, like Florida's. They give people an immunity from prosecution. You never get to trial because a judge decides first whether or not you have a Stand Your Ground defense. So Zimmerman's lawyers didn't use this. If they had, they would have had that hearing, right? They went right to trial, traditional self-defense. And I know you've all probably read all the media stuff, but basically Zimmerman's version of the events was that he got out of the car, to see which way Trayvon Martin was going when he turned around to go back. Trayvon had circled around, confronted him at his car, punched him, knocked him on the ground, straddled him, and was beating him and punching him in the face, and he was yelling for help. And in the struggle, the gun came out, and Trayvon was killed. That's basically the story that the jury heard in this case. So, all right. Now, after that evidence that goes in, the jury gets read the instructions, which is the law of the case. And I know I'm running out of time. They've already held up a sign that said wrap up. But I want to real quickly go over some of the instructions with you, right? This is exactly what the jury heard from the judge. I mean, just excerpts of it. A person is justified in using deadly force if he reasonably believes that force is necessary to prevent imminent death or great bodily harm to himself. In deciding whether George Zimmerman was justified in the use of deadly force, you must judge him by the circumstances he was surrounded at the time the force was used. The danger to George Zimmerman need not have been actual. However, to justify the use of force, the appearance of danger must have been so real that a reasonable person under the same circumstances would have used force. Let's see. Okay. And then, after reading that, some more law, the judge said a couple of other things to the jury. Said, you must follow the law as it's set out in these instructions. And the judge said, this case must be decided only on the evidence you've heard from the testimony of the witnesses and have seen in the form of exhibits. And then the judge said, your feelings about this case should not influence your decision. This case must not be decided for or against anyone because you feel sorry for them or because you feel angry at them. Whatever verdict you enter must be unanimous. Your verdict should not be influenced by feelings of prejudice, bias, or sympathy. It must be based on the evidence and on the law contained in these instructions. And she closed with this sentence. Even if you do not like the laws that must be applied, you must use them. For two centuries, we've lived by the Constitution and the law. No juror has the right to violate the rules that we all share. That's the instruction that went to the jury in this case. And so, you don't have to answer this question again, but I just want you to read it again, and I want to ask you, thinking about this kind of a scenario, if now you can believe, or maybe your mind is more open to the idea, that the jury system worked appropriately in this case. Taking what the jury had, the things that inflame us all in this case, that kind of evidence was not admissible as a matter of law. Racism, unless the case is a hate crime, racism in and of itself is not admissible in a court of law. This jury trial wasn't about whether Zimmerman was a racist. It was about whether he was guilty of murder beyond a reasonable doubt and whether the use of deadly force was reasonable under the circumstances. That's what they had. I know I'm a lawyer. I know I have a bias. But I don't think you can blame the jury system for this. The United States jury system is really based on a democratic model. You get a small group of citizens and they're randomly chosen to sit in this trial. They're chosen from a larger group. They listen to both sides, and based on what they hear, they decide the facts of the case. Our jury system, one of its purposes is to keep the public involved in the justice process. It injects common sense, and it injects community norms. But if the norm is prejudice, then that's what you're going to get too. That's the system, and I'm going to leave it up to a discussion, I hope, from all of you to tell us how we can change it. Thank you.
Ronald?
Yeah. I can project so I can speak from here. Maria and I did not coordinate our presentations, but they couldn't be coordinated better because the remarks that I prepared deal with perhaps defining racism really quickly, but then talking about why the jury system may not be the problem, but it is the law itself. I think it's important that I define racism. I define racism as the belief that there are physical, intellectual, moral, and propensities that are immutable, unchangeable, and are genetically determined. That is to say that, you know, if you create the classic, you know, Hellenistic bipolar construct, you know, and you say we would put white on one column and black in the other, and you would do a check system, that you have qualities that are present in the whites that are not present in blacks, qualities that are present in blacks that are not present in whites, and that those differences are natural, that they are based in the individual and they are unchangeable. One of the things I want to argue is that before there was law, that before there was race inscribed in American law, before there was slave laws, there was a public perception that was carried out in the conduct of the law and the adjudication of the process that was racial. And I want to haggle over whether it's racist or racial, but it certainly was based on a common perception that if there were immutable differences between individuals and that those differences were based on race. Virginia, for instance, did not enact slave laws until the 1660s. And if you study Virginia law, you will not find laws on the books that enact slavery, that create a category in which an individual is at labor for life and is the property of an individual for life, and the progeny of that individual, whether male or female, also have the same status as their, you know, as their parents. But there's an interesting case that transpired in 1641 in Virginia that involved three indentured servants. The one was Scotland, one was Irish, the other was black. The black man's name was John Punch. Now, what had happened is they were indentured servants. They had, had a seven-year classic indenture. Well, what they did was they ran away from their indenture. They ran to Maryland. They were captured in Maryland, brought back to Virginia, and they faced the law. Now, mind you, this is before Virginia had laws about slavery. So there's nothing on the books that legally, such as, you know, the post-Civil War black codes that said that blacks would be treated one way, whites would be treated another. But what happened in their in the adjudication case is real interesting. The two white men were whipped, and they had time added to their indenture. John Punch was whipped, and he was indentured for life. See, this is before Virginia has slave laws. I find it interesting, for instance, that the youngest individual ever executed in the United States was a young black woman named Bett, who was convicted of arson in Albany, not Albany, Georgia, but Albany, New York, in the 1740s. She and another young black man, Dean, he was 14, she was 12, were convicted of setting fire in Albany and damaging several buildings and everything. And they were tried, you know, they were executed. You know, the youngest individual ever executed, you know, in this country legally by the state. I'm not going to, you know, raise the question of lynchings and all those, that other kind of stuff and everything. There's one other case I want to raise. There was a woman by the name of Lena Baker in Georgia. Lena Baker was a domestic worker. And she was attacked by her boss, you know, by her employer and everything, you know, and she killed him. And her defense was self-defense, that this was a legitimate, you know, defense, you know, of physical attack. She was found guilty in a one-day trial. And within 90 days of the time of the offense, she had been executed. She was exonerated in 2005 because her descendants, you know, fought for years and everything, and there were records available and all that other kind of stuff, and the same state apparatus, not the same individuals, but the same state apparatus that sentenced her to death and executed her within 90 days exonerated her because when fresh set of eyes and a fresh generation of, you know, looked at the facts of the case, it was self-defense. She had been attacked, and, you know, and all of that. You know, when I'm not disagreeing with you know, my colleague, but I think that there's one thing that we, you know, really have to consider in thinking about, you know, the legal system, you know, and the jury system. And that is that if the laws, and I, you know, I could cite the late Adlian Higginbotham, who wrote a very influential book, In a Matter of Color. Who, and what he does, he goes from the colonial period, and that's where I got a lot of my information from, and he documents how in the North and the South, whether it's New Jersey, Virginia, Alabama, that you can't separate attitudes about a immutable and natural difference between blacks and whites as something that goes into the informing of the law. That what that presents for us in 2013, in my opinion, is the fact that we have to realize that the problem is the law itself. That so one of the things that I read in the Trayvon Martin case, and I agree with everything that Maria said, I take it a step further, though. Whatever happened to the public perception of Trayvon Martin's right to self-defense? You know, we can cite case law that, for instance, in New York State after 1741, free blacks were forbidden to carry weapons. Okay, part of that has to do with the fact that there were two alleged slave revolts in New York City, one in 1712 and the other in 1741. And after the 1714 alleged conspiracy, there were several whites and blacks that were hung, you know, in New York in 1741. As a matter of fact, you can go to Lower Manhattan and everything and see the spot where the hangings took place. They were done in public. Well, free blacks were forbidden to carry weapons and everything. You know, so at the set, you know, it's just a generation later that Bill of Rights comes along and the right to bear arms. But at the time that the Bill of Rights gave white citizens the right to carry guns, you know, to bear arms, in the state of New York, free blacks were forbidden to have firearms. I want to argue those things have always been there. And that there's no, so that it shouldn't surprise us that we get to, you know, how many of you, did any of you know when the first white man was executed in America for the murder of a black man? It wasn't the James Byrd case. A lot of people think it was the James Byrd case. It was not. The three white men who were convicted of killing James Byrd, two of them have been executed, one is still waiting death row. But there's an earlier case, 1 minute. And it's an interesting case because CBS News made a TV special about this. It was a case in which a black man who was in prison was in prison for killing the mother and stepfather of a young white man. This young white man, his last name was Cimo, C-I-M-O, then hired a white man in the same prison to kill this man. He gave him the explosive that the inmate put into the black inmate's cell to kill him. You know, the murder took place. The white man, the inmate was convicted of a murder while he was in prison, was sentenced to death, and was executed. The man who hired him was sentenced to 8.5 years and did 3 months in prison, and CBS did a television special about him that aired in 1987. When you stop and think about that, I think it supports my argument that the problem is the law itself, so that, you know, 2013, we think about what to do about the Trayvon Martin case. You know, we can advise our young black men especially to be mindful, you know, of what's going on when they have contacts with the police, contacts with the general population. But I think that they really would be most productive if we really take a serious look at the nature of the law and begin to work through the legislatures, however we can, to change the law.
Can we move on and come back to these kind of questions? Mm-hmm. Reginald? All right, we're Alex.
Reginald.
Okay. Lisa wasn't here.
Okay.
Thank you. I think mine picks up nicely following what Professor Tyson mentioned, the idea of thinking about what do we tell our sons? What do we tell? If Trayvon Martin can be a victim of interracial murder, an unarmed teen wearing a hoodie and walking supposedly aimlessly, then can anyone argue that America has accepted a post-black group? Following the Trayvon Martin verdict, I noticed on the internet a statement by Tore Noblet, a cultural critic and author, who stated in an MSNBC interview, fit the image, in response to raising and answering the question, what do I tell my son? Teray also included in that interview how he recalled his mother advising him during his youth to keep his hands out of his pockets when in public and to act compliant when approached by police. We've also heard or read, even in like English One composition, Steele mentioning that he whistles Vivaldi, right, as another example. Upon reading this, I immediately reacted with what? Simply assimilate or worse, fit into the mold of a double standard? I was shocked by Touré's words. But he felt this case only reconfirms racial injustice in America. His response inspired me to read his 2011 book titled Who's Afraid of Post-Blackness? What It Means to Be Black Now. Trayvon's premise in this book is that all expressions of blackness should be permissible. He has already contradicted himself. He continues with blacks are not only one category, just as they are people from any culture or individual. Someone black should be able to express in any number of ways, through looks, style, demeanor, language. Michael Eric Dyson, professor of sociology of Georgetown University and the writer of the foreword of Touré's book, states that blacks fall within one of three dimensions: accidental, incidental, or intentional. Touré substitutes these words with introvert, ambivert, and extrovert. Since code switching is likely, someone black might change his or her style or language depending on the situation or audience. I feel Touré's book is relevant to Trayvon Martin's case and all the Trayvon Martins out there because it argues that the quote-unquote authentic black is not just one way. Touré was spurred to write this book when he heard classmates on more than one occasion say to him, "You ain't black." This plunged a wound in him. The concept of post-blackness originated, or quote, "The concept of post-blackness originated in the art world in the late 1990s by Ligon and his chum Thelma Golden, the curator of the Studio Museum of Harlem. The two of them discussed how black visual arts was changing. People would now look at, for example, a Kara Walker silhouette-style picture of slavery and respond to it in a new way. Slytherin carnage could now be played with, even mocked." When Golden did a show in 2001 titled Freestyle, it rocked. Many of the artists, however, were offended that the works were not considered overtly black. At any rate, the concept post-black was born. Because of an emotional distance that a black can have as a response to a work, blacks can face struggle. Just as Dave Chappelle is able to weave black and white like a toy, Wahima Lubiano states, quote, "One of the things I associate with what people are calling post-black is the determination not to have history weigh on our individual shoulders as someone that's only and always serious. Therefore, we can play with stereotypes and caricatures that were casting us." Close quote. In other words, you find a peace where you step out of your trauma. There is also aware that even in the mindset of shifting among blacks, it does not mean that it is a shifting among the larger America or the world. Touré shares the following embarrassing story. In 2002, and this is him speaking, "In 2002, I went to Italy to work on my second book. It was a two-month writer's retreat and attended predominantly by professors from prestigious colleges. You had to apply, and the competition was stiff. I got in, and while present among the group, a Helen Vindler, who I found out was a famous Harvard poetry professor, unabashedly asked me, 'How did you get here?' I paused and replied, 'By plane.'" Touré considers the way one might react to a stereotype as a microaggression, and the microaggression can take its toll in and cause rage. And then I'm about to close. "Without rage, one can deal with cases such as the 1980 Atlanta killings of black boys and girls that the news media considered irrelevant. Finally, without rage, one can comment on the Trayvon Martin case as Barack Obama did when he said, and I'm paraphrasing, 'I hope the stand your ground,' and as Professor mentioned, also thinking of Castle Ground. But Stand Your Ground law will be re-reviewed. Is anyone afraid of post-Black America? Shouldn't Blacks be able to choose their mode of expression? Where do you stand? Thank you.
Lisa Tucker came in late. Lisa is a professor of English here at the college, and we didn't have a chance to introduce her.
Thank you.
Alex Gray or Reginald?
Good. Alex, you should go ahead. Good afternoon. I'm not a professor here. I'm not an attorney. I am not an activist. However, I do have a perspective on the situation. I am assistant principal, and I am a father of a Black male. My son, Bryce, is 10 years old. He is non-athletic. I wish he was, but he's not. He plays three instruments very well, a pianist, a violinist, and he plays the clarinet. He is above grade level in math and reading. He is very polite. He is a little guy. He sings in a choir and actually plays for our children's choir at our church. Loves his little sister, six-year-old sister Arden, and some of his best friends are white, Indian, Hispanic, Asian. However, this summer I had to have a conversation with him because despite the young man he is, a very non-threatening young man that I know is going to be very successful, I had to talk to him about a very real situation that occurred when the verdict came out regarding Trayvon Martin. And it's a conversation I never suspected to have with, he's not even 10 yet, he'll be 10 in October, but with a 9-year-old, to have a conversation about his behavior, his actions, and how despite being a non-threatening young man, something that happened to Trayvon Martin could very well happen to him. And that was disheartening to me as a father that feels like my wife and I are doing the right things to raise our son to be an upstanding young man. However, regardless of the things that we're teaching him, any given day that he leaves our home, he could be in danger. And that is something that I'm not sure everyone in our country is faced with. And everyone in our country or every parent of a child has to struggle with on a daily basis. And my father raised me in a similar way. The things that I'm teaching my son, my father, who is still with my mother after many years, he taught me those same things. And I found myself teaching my 9-year-old son, when we're in the store, don't touch anything. Don't be loud. Don't be boisterous. He always questions, Daddy, why do I have to wear this button-down shirt when we go certain places? Or why do I have to wear this? Or why do you pick out my clothes? Why can't I pick out my own clothes? But I understand how something as simple as wearing the wrong thing or being too loud in the wrong place or touching something in the store when you have no intentions of taking it but simply touching it could cause you to be accused of something, even for a 9-year-old boy. And working in a public school system as assistant principal, I wish I could say that similar things don't happen in our public schools or our schools in general, public or private, but they do. And it's disheartening to see how our Black males are looked at differently. And we can say it's not so. We can deny it and say, no, we're in a different society today and things are better. And they are better, but they're still not where they should be. And my comments would simply be, We need to be reflective, each one of us, regardless of where we stand with the situation, regardless of, you know, what skin color we happen to have or what our ethnicity is. What are we doing to make a difference and to change how this world is? We can focus on the Zimmerman side of the situation, but I immediately looked at the Trayvon Martin side, and I immediately thought, did he do something wrong? You know, did he act in a way that may have led to him being attacked or targeted? Did he say something or wear something or do something? And I realized that at the end of the day, what my responsibility is to help educate others, help educate young men. And I not only have a son, I'm not only assistant principal where I work with young men and young women, but I also have a mentoring program through my fraternity where we work with black males. And I have about 50 black males that I work with on a regular basis. And we talk about how life is not fair. Should Trayvon Martin have been targeted? No. But because he was, we have to look at how we respond to each and every situation that we're in. And we all have a role in helping turn things around. We have a role in how we look at others, how we treat others, how we respond to others that are different. And we all need to look at what can we do to make a difference. Not complain about the verdict, not complain about George Zimmerman, not target people out of anger, but be reflective and look at what can we do to help make a difference and change the situation so that all of us can live in a safer society.
Thank you. And our last presenter is Alex Gray.
Oh, no. Actually, Reginald Johnson. Oh. I switched on that. Yes. I get to go last because I'm the oldest on the panel here. And I do. I do mourn the death of Trayvon Martin, but I've been president of the NAACP for over 24 years, and there's been plenty of Trayvon Martins whose lives have been taken, either through law enforcement or vigilantes. Altogether, there's been 8 that I could think of just in Middlesex County alone. We've had to bury an African-American male adult, a female adult, and 6 children. One ran away from police officer because he had a child support issues, even at the tender age of, 17, and was shot in the back. We had a case where a young man was picked up on the parkway, ran behind one of the rest stops, waded through a pond, and because, of course, he didn't have a belt, he was surrounded by law enforcement, and when he went to pull his pants up, one of the officers said he has a weapon, and he was shot 12 times. We deal with this on a regular basis, so we take this very serious. Due to time, I'm going to just jump into the summation of my presentation and just talk about some of the things that we do as NAACPers. One of my charges is to go out to the community and provide answers as to how to deal with this 800-pound gorilla we call law enforcement. Many of the things that we do when we talk to communities is we encourage them to set up either block associations or even neighborhood watches, not so much to encourage vigilantism, but to have the community talk to each other, address issues, and to see whether or not they share common problems when it comes not only to issues that relate to their community, but also to law enforcement issues. We visit municipal courts. One of the most interesting activity that each of you can have is to visit your municipal court. It's great activity if you're not there for a reason. Just to see who the defendants are, and All you have to do is to be equipped with a population map, census map, just to find out what the racial makeup is in that community, only to go there to see the imbalance of defendants in each of their courts. It's quite interesting. I can go on that just alone. We also encourage police departments to set up junior police academies and auxiliary police academy classes because we want the public to be educated on what their rights are, and also to have police. You'd be surprised. Sometimes this is the first time police have any interaction with the public during police. You know, because what we've gotten away from community policing, and now we put our police officers in vehicles. So there's a detachment between that and the community. We encourage people to visit their council meetings, because once you get known as to who you are, it gives you power, especially if your councilman knows who you are. If you have to deal with issues, that's a great place to start with. Also, we talk about joining human rights organizations, whether it's the NAACP, ACLU, National Network, American Conference on Diversity. There's many organizations that are out here, and you can set up your own little programs and deal with forming ways of communicating with law enforcement. But the most important issue, the most important thing you can do is vote. I can't tell you how many times I visit a community that has just suffered from a case of either police brutality or unarmed youth dying, and only to find out that only 8% of the community has voted in the last election. That's why you have this imbalance of law enforcement in one area and not in the other. And also, we have, if all fails, we've been involved in what we call citizen arrests. Altogether, in 20 years, I think we've arrested six police officers under citizen arrest. And why you're saying go through that process, sometimes there are other avenues you can go to, internal affairs, police internal affairs. Also, when you do, if you decide to go through internal affairs, make sure that you send a copy to your local prosecutor's office, because sometimes this information doesn't circulate it from internal affairs to the police department. So if you have issues with police, do both. And finally, as I get the see the hook coming, is is the fact that there are ways of handling this. You just have to be proactive. And thank you.
Quite a diverse panel. We've had a legal interpretation, a historical, an artistic literary interpretation, certainly a personal educational, and an organizational perspective.